The following presentation is brought to you by Priority One.
I think we can get started now. I'm going to first say thank you very much for coming. I'm a big fan of Priority One, and it's a privilege to be here. So, we're speaking about parenting.
Okay, as we move along, if you have any questions, you have any comments, if any thoughts, if anything is not clear, please, by all means, feel free to ask. Since we don't have such a big group, I'd like to make this talk as practical and as useful as possible. So at any point, at any time, if you have any question, even on what we're speaking about or something else, please feel free to ask. Okay, first off, as my Bubba used to say, there are two things a parent can't take credit for: how the kids turn out and how the children turns out. Because a parent can still put all the ingredients in, do everything right, and somehow you come out with a different product. So we're not talking about guarantees, certainly not money back guarantee. We're talking about putting the odds in your favor. What can we do statistically that helps to turn the tide to help us to raise kids who are emotionally solvent, healthy, high self-esteem, and good confidence? So the first thing to understand is that there have been more books, more lectures, more seminars, more tapes on parenting, effective chinuch, and we seem, oh, hi, welcome. Hi, we're just beginning. The art of origami. Okay. Okay, so we're speaking about parenting and raising emotionally healthy children, and we began by saying that with every generation, it seems like kids are getting less and less emotionally healthy, less and less emotionally solvent, with more experts and with more people seemingly telling us what it is we need to do. So first we have to understand that children do not gain self-esteem the same way adults do. I'm going to give you the brief psychological model for how adults gain self-esteem, and then we're going to switch to children since I want to spend the bulk of our time on that. But it's important to draw a contrast. How adults gain self-esteem is as follows. There are essentially three forces within a human being. You've got the body, the ego, and the soul. Put very briefly, the body wants to do what feels good. Our ego wants to do what looks good. And our neshama, our soul, wants to do what truly is good. The alarm clock goes off in the morning and they all battle it out. Anytime a person overindulges in the body, eats in excess sleep, excess entertainment, temporarily it feels good. Afterwards, we simply like ourselves less. And too with the ego. Anytime you buy something you can't afford, make a joke at someone else's expense, do something merely to project an image so that other people see us in a certain way, temporarily feels pretty good. Afterwards, we simply like ourselves less. However, when an adult makes the choice to do what is right instead of what feels good or looks good, that is how we gain self-esteem, with this beautiful gift that we call free will. And only human beings are endowed with free will. A horse, for example, can't look at a bale of hay and go, oh, it looks good, but nah, better not, got a chasana coming up, right? Only human beings can choose to do what they want to do in spite of what they feel like doing. And that is how we gain self-esteem. However, by children, it's a different equation. Children do not have a yetzer tov until 12 or 13 for girls and boys respectively. They're completely yetzer hara driven. We know adults like this as well, but at least children have an excuse for it. Children do not have a yetzer tov, so they can't gain self-esteem from making good choices. Now, of course, encouraging your child, as we're going to speak about, to make a good choice is fundamental to being a good parent. But that's not how they're going to gain the self-esteem. Here is how children generally gain self-esteem, by and large. And again, we say by and large, there are lots of asterisks that go here. And you can pretty much do this one thing and avoid everything else. And you put the odds in your favor. If you don't do this one thing and you do all the other things, you put the odds against you. We're going to cover those other things too, but this one is first and foremost paramount in terms of infusing your child with a healthy sense of self-esteem, and that is as follows. A child must be made to feel like he or she is a path to the parent's happiness and not the obstacle to it. Any child that grows up that's made to feel like an obligation, like a chore, like they're getting in the way of their parents' happiness, will have a very hard time developing a sense of healthy self-esteem. Because as we said, children are egocentric, which means the entire world revolves around them. So if the parent is unhappy, the parent is miserable being around the child will naturally conclude, I must be a miserable person. there must be something inherently flawed and wrong with me. And that is how children develop low self-esteem. I was at a Shabbos table not too long ago, my family and this other family, and this wife began to go on and on about this awful experience she had where she was trapped in the house for 24 hours with these little people that resembled her and her husband. She called it a snow day. And on the snow day, she said how her day was completely ruined. It was shot. The kids were home and she couldn't get anything done. And I'm looking at her, I'm looking at her children. They're sitting there eating their fish, just listening to what she's saying. And I look over at my wife and she looks back at me and she says, "Don't say anything." I said, "Come on." She goes, "This is why we don't get invited back." So I didn't say anything. Shalom bias, another talk, very important. But she began to go on and on. And then she began to say, "Hi, welcome." So we're talking about the importance of punctuality. No, okay. Then she began to say how when her kids go on the school bus in the morning, her day begins. And when the kids come home, her day is just ruined. And she goes on and on and on. You know, I give workshops around the country, and I give a long workshop where I live in Lakewood on the subject. And when I got to this point, one of the women burst out in tears. Now, if you know this woman, she pretty much cries at all of my workshops. Nonetheless, I always feel compelled to ask her, "What did I say this time?" And on this point, she said, "But that's how I feel. When my kids go on the bus in the morning, I have some peace. And when they get home, it's crazy." I said, "I understand. As a parent, we all feel that way. There's a difference, though, between recognizing and feeling that your children are a lot of work and telling them that. Children are a complete blessing. They are a tremendous privilege, but they're a lot of work. And a child that feels like they're simply a burden, that they're getting in the way of the parents' happiness, will have a very hard time feeling good about themselves. So there are a myriad of ways to communicate to your child that they bring you joy. And the ubiquitous dinner conversation, one second please, doesn't accomplish anything. Don't think that 20 minutes, "Hi, how was your day? Good, fine." I said, "Don't do that. Use two hands. Why'd you spill it? Fine, go play." It doesn't do a whole lot. Right? Better the child should feel actual joy. Do you ever realize how often you do or don't smile at your child? Not when they do something and they, you know, they want, you know, like a little fake smile, like, "Oh wow, you built that beautifully." Particularly the child that may give you the bit greatest challenge, how often you genuinely give a huge, bright, beaming smile. See, what can people do when you smile? Smile back. Well, apparently some of you have been able to not do that, right? When you smile, it's a natural tendency to smile back. Now, we don't realize that we convey a lot with our nonverbal communication, and a child picks up. They're very smart. They're very, very intuitive. And when the child gets a sense like they're simply a burden, they're going to feel like that. And you can inoculate them against the "I'm not worth much" disease if, when they're growing up, you're able to communicate again the fundamental message that you are the path to my happiness and not the obstacle to it. Now, much more goes into the proverbial cholent pot than that, but that is fundamental. And now we're going to cover statistically what studies show us are the most necessary things we need to do in order to tip the balance and raise kids that are emotionally healthy, high self-esteem, confidence, and emotional resiliency. You had a question, please.
What is the main age that we're talking about in terms of developing this type of sense of self-esteem? Like, what's the age range where it's most crucial?
Excellent question. So the question is, what is the age range when it's most crucial? Certainly during the formative years when a child is growing up, it's sort of like wet cement. Once a child reaches a certain age, generally, you know, young teenage, the cement sort of solidifies. It doesn't mean that they can't work on their self-esteem, and there are other things that, time permitting, we'll talk about for older children or even parents with adult children, which is a whole different model. But the when they're growing up, when they're under your care, when they gain self-esteem from you, that is the most crucial phase.
No, it's
generally up until the age of young, so the tween age, the 12, 13, but up until that's the most crucial.
Starting
at, you know, infancy. You know, there are different ways to communicate self-esteem. Certainly, we don't need to cover hold your child and You know, don't put your child in a dark room in the closet. So, you know, we're talking about when we can actually communicate with our child, and it's going to be different whether the child is 2 or 3, whether the child's 14, 15. How you communicate to that child that they bring you joy is going to change based on the child's age, but their need for it, it remains the same. Yes?
Put a blur between parents having dreams and hopes that will be realized between their children, where it's actually very good, or where it actually turns into Mickey Mantle.
Oh, turns out to be what?
Mickey Mantle.
No, I know he's a baseball player, but yeah, I'm not sure the reference.
His father pushed him to be a baseball player.
Oh, okay.
And an alcoholic too.
So. Got it. So what's the question?
I'm looking back at Holocaust parents.
Yeah.
Who had dreams and aspirations
right.
for their parents. Their lives were messed up.
Right.
They didn't always have the
right.
the things where people brought up in the camps. They didn't have the parents.
Right.
But they did have dreams and aspirations for their kids, which
sure.
their kids were very much aware of.
Right.
And were some of those dreams and aspirations actually, according to what you just said, a lot more positive than we would imagine? Because you knew that you were the future.
Got
that
it.
You knew.
Right. It's a fine question. The truth is I've never considered it, but it would seem to make sense.
Okay.
Yeah. I think it's a profound point. Okay, so just in the interest of 8:10, okay.
7:10 for passing in Chicago.
Thank you. Okay, now, what goes into the proverbial chalumpant, as we said? Any parent will tell us that the two most difficult times in raising any child is when? Twos and?
Teens.
Thank you. Right, I gave this talk once, and a bleary-eyed woman raised her head and said, morning and night, put it back down. Right, terrific twos and teens, what do they both have in common?
Rebellion.
Yes, rebellion, but why?
Independence.
Independence, very good. Human beings are wired by Hashem to have a sense of independence. It is most pronounced during the twos and teens. That is when a child at twos, 2 and 3, begins to develop a sense of I, a sense of identity. They recognize a separateness and they want to do everything themselves. Yes, it can take a 2-year-old an hour and a half to put on his pants, but he wants to do it himself. Well, those with adult or with teenage girls may recognize it all takes a while to get dressed, but at that point, at these points, they want to do everything themselves. Now, children need to gain a sense of independence, and you need to give it to them in a way that is halakhically and legally permitted, or they're going to take it. What happens when kids go off the proverbial derrick is they want to expand, they want to experience a sense of freedom, a sense of independence. So they expand out. What is the parent's natural inclination? To tighten. What is the child's natural inclination?
Life.
And the parents. And then they say, we've got a problem. Of course you have a problem. Right? Each person is doing what they're designed to do. But a parent that recognizes that a child needs to express his or her individuality and gives them a sense of freedom, they will find the child less inclined to take it in ways that are not permissible. What does a teenager do when they want to feel like an adult? Smoke. Drink. Right? These are things that are not particularly fun or tasty, but adults do them. So they want to feel grown up. So whatever way is, again, halakhically and legally permissibly, whatever it is that you and your spouse decide, this is what we're going to allow our child to do. You may not agree with everything, right? The socks may not match. You may not like the shirt. You may not even like the friends. You may not like the toy. You may not like a lot of things, but you have to give them a degree of freedom. It can't be where everything is no. Because make no mistake, while they're under your control, you can get away with it. But the minute they become more, again, quote-unquote adult, they're going to take what they need in order to feel grown up. And better, they should be given it so they don't feel the need to take it. So children need a sense of autonomy, a sense of individuality, in whatever way is age appropriate. Yes, please.
How do you know where to draw the line?
How do you know where to draw the line with how the time before? It's an excellent question. So I'm just going to skip ahead. You're on page 4, I'm on page 3, but we'll cover that right now. And that is as follows. Every parent can finish a sentence, but few of us actually do it. You need to be able to pick your... Yeah. Do you do it?
Yeah.
Yes? Great. All the time?
A 2-year-old walked around in a girl's shirt all day Friday.
All right, good for you. I'll assume he's a boy. Okay. If you make everything a battle, you're going to not only lose the war, but you'll lose the individual battles. Because what does the child do? They know that when you're worn down, when you're hungry, when you're tired, they've got a shot. So they're going to keep on pushing at everything. When a family learns to draw lines and to pick their battles and to say, this is acceptable and this is not, they find the house is a lot more shalom in it. The reason is because the kids know that there's not going to be any way that you're going to budge on specific issues. But if a child doesn't know when you're going to give in, and you don't know when you're going to give in, it behooves them to keep on asking. They're smart. And if they've got a 10, 20, 35% chance, why not? It doesn't cost them anything. And you're going to find that the discipline issues diminish greatly, because a lot of discipline revolves around behavior where you're not being clear about the line. I read a beautiful article once in one of the publications about a woman who's watching a man shop Erev Shabbos in the supermarket with his kids hanging all over the shopping cart. And they were picking up one cereal after another, this, and the father kept saying, no, too much sugar, can't have this, caffeine, no, you're allergic to that. They got to something, and the father simply said, no, it's not kosher. Bless you. And that was the end of the conversation. It wasn't like, oh, come on, maybe you hold by this symbol, maybe that. It wasn't that. It was the end of the conversation, because the child knew that that was not negotiable. Imagine if all the things where you drew the line was that clear to the child. And you can reset this barometer at any age. Sometimes a parent will say, okay, fine, I hear the idea, I like it, it makes sense to me, but you don't know my kid. They're going to push no matter how many times I say no. I encourage you to try it and go to the mat on it. Anyone here familiar with the idea of Ferberizing? What that is? Right? Basically, it is an awful system which I absolutely do not endorse, but I bring it up for a reason. And there are two sheaths on this, to be clear. Plenty of people think it's wonderful. The short explanation of Ferberizing is as follows. You have a beautiful little baby. Maybe the boy is walking around in a girl's shirt. I don't know, whatever the story is. And when the child is young, you put them in the crib. They cry all night long. You don't go in. Put them in the crib the next time. They cry. 5 hours, they stop. The next night, they cry. 3 hours, they stop. By the end of the week, put the child down. Child doesn't cry. It works. Yeah, of course it works. Yeah. The child has learned that you are not going to come in spite of the cries. If the infant gets the message after a week, your teenager is surely to get it at some point. Okay, so please be clear about appreciating the fact that if you're positive about your convictions, it will translate into a greater appreciation from your child, knowing that you're not going to budge on this. There's a deeper psychological reason as to why we can't be wishy-washy when it comes to drawing lines and picking battles. Rev Yitzchak Berkowitz says a beautiful point, and that is that a child needs a fundamental sense of trust. They need to be able to trust the parent. For their own emotional selves, they need to be able to know that they can count on their mother and or father. When a child is told one thing and then persists and then is told something else, the trust dissolves. You're training your child that you can't be trusted. So if you think that by giving in on this lollipop, after all the begging, the arguing, and the screaming, and you just can't take it anymore, you'll be making your life easier, it'll be quiet for 10 minutes, no doubt, unless you've got a little boy like mine that crunches after 3 times. It's quiet for 5 seconds. It is fundamental to their emotional well-being that the child be able to trust you, which is why parents need to be very firm about where they draw the lines. So to answer your question, where do you draw the line and what's acceptable or not, you have to decide that ahead of time, and where you draw it, you have to be very clear about where the line is drawn. Any questions so far?
This gate be used for an innate heat for rebellion?
Pardon me, please? Where's rebellion? I think it's clear because we're wired to rebel.
No. I'm going to say, where does a child feel a real sense of rebellion in this system? If the rules are clear, so where's the rebellion? Or is rebellion oversimplifying it? This is what my dad allows me to do. I want to fight for my own.
Okay, fine. So the question is this: where is the room for rebellion? So a child, like any adult, acts in their own best interest, right? That's clear, particularly children. So if they've got no shot of wearing you down, it's no point to it. The reason they keep on pushing you, in spite of your unconscious musings, is really not to make your life miserable. They don't wake up in the morning and say, let me see how I can get my mother angry. Let's see what we can, there's milk. Whoa, there we go, right? It doesn't happen. They really don't have, it seems like they have that intention to do that, but they don't. So a child will act in their own best interest. If they've got no shot, they got no shot, they're not gonna pursue it. Okay. Yeah?
But don't teenagers, so then where is the expression of my own individuality and just because in the world it's okay even though my parents...
I hear the question. Children need a sense of independence, they need a sense of autonomy. That does not mean that there's no structure and there's no rules. We, just like children, right, we have obligations, we have the Torah, we have things that we have to do, we have a structure, we have an order to our lives, we have a Seder. So within that, we have a degree of autonomy.
So they're going to know that there are some of the things that they're doing that you don't really want them to do. That they're going to be aware of.
For sure. At the same time, they're also going to know that the things that they absolutely can't do, in spite of how much they cry, complain, and kvetch. Okay. Rabbi Abraham Twersky gives a beautiful story in one of his books, and he talks about a family that goes out for dinner, and the waitress goes around to everyone, and she gets to the boy, and the boy says, I'll have a hamburger with french fries and a Coke. And the mother says, just bring him a turkey sandwich with some chips and a seltzer. So 10 minutes later, the waitress comes by, and lo and behold, what does she put down in front of the boy? Hamburger, french fries, and a Coke. And the child looks at the mother and she says, look, mom, she thinks I'm real. Yeah? Children need to be respected. However we define that, whatever way is age appropriate, we can't run roughshod over them. They do listen. Sometimes we speak about our children like they're not in the room. In some cases, it's fine. We're saying, do you know what Shloimeh did today? He was such a mitzvah boy. That stuff is fine. But the stuff like, I don't know what we're going to do with him. No, I don't know what. And he's sitting right there. You know, a little respect goes a long way. Yerachmiel Milstein. Rabbi Yerachmiel Milstein. Yeah, please. I'm sorry, my ears are still clogged from the flight. Pardon? Oh, fine, very good. The question is, what should the mother have done to make the child feel real? So first off, you can always give a child what we call the illusion of control. This is a very big technique in sales. Instead of simply telling the child, I want you to do this, they'll say, do you want to have, wear the blue shirt or the red shirt? But confining their choice to something that's acceptable. In this way, the child gets to express the degree of autonomy. At the same time, you're confining to something that you can live with. So you wouldn't say, what on the menu do you want? Rather, you would say, oh, the turkey sandwich, chicken sandwich, and, meatloaf, which do you prefer? So, okay.
Give it close
then. Exactly right. So, Rabbi Yerachmiel, I even know Rabbi Yerachmiel Milstein is a terrific speaker, great educator. So I asked him once, of all the talks you give, what is the most important talk that you have, the most important lecture? And he says, easily parenting. I said, of parenting, what's the most important idea that you give over? And I asked him this because I figure if I take my parenting talk and add his one great idea, then my talk has to be better than his, right? So he said as follows. He goes, what do you think is the average praise to criticism ratio an average child hears? How many times does a child hear one bit of praise to one bit of criticism? I'm not checking messages, I'm just seeing what time it is. 23. Okay. How many times do you think the child hears a bit of praise to criticism? Okay.
1 to 10.
Pardon me?
1 to 10.
1 to 10. Okay. Anyone else? Pardon me?
I'm
Higher than that.
100.
Who said that? Tough ass. Okay, 1 to 100. Anyone else? Okay, so studies show us, and I'm sure it's got as high as that, I think probably in my house growing up, 1 to 40. The average child hears one bit of praise to 40 bits of criticism. And if you think about it, it kind of makes sense. Every time you're conscious of, oh, that's very nice, Chaim, it's stop doing that, take your hands off of that, use two hands, take off your sneakers, why are you doing this? It's a constant stream of criticism. I speak on Shalom Bias a lot. It's one of my more favorite subjects to talk on because just of its relevancy and importance. And this is a very similar idea that we echo, and that is praise and criticism. When it comes to Shalom Bias, certainly there are times our spouse could do things that are smarter, easier, cheaper, faster, better, but it doesn't mean we have to point it out. And when spouses learn to censor themselves with each other, they need not point everything wrong with the other spouse. They find things are just a little bit nicer and calmer, and the other spouse generally reciprocates. And when it comes to children, we have to be clear that we are their emotional source of nourishment. And if they constantly hear criticism, they can't feel very good about themselves. Can you imagine if you had a job and you heard 40 bits of criticism, one bit of praise? Right? Unless it's Department of Motor Vehicles, it's not very good odds. So a parent needs to be aware, they need to be conscious of how many times they're criticizing their child. Now, when it comes to praise, when it comes to criticism, something else we have to be aware of. When it comes to criticism, we all know you should criticize the act or the child. The act, thank you, ladies. When it comes to praise, we also have to criticize the act and not the child. Studies show us that a child that grows up that's made to feel good merely because they possess a particular trait or characteristic will develop sort of an egocentric sense of self, right? Because they're only being praised for who they are. Now, as adults, we know, in the beginning we talked about self-esteem, which, by the way, is in Real Power, right? Conveniently located here. We talked about how adults gain self-esteem and emotional well-being, and that's from making good choices. Children need to learn to develop that muscle. So therefore, it's nothing wrong, absolutely nothing wrong, with praising a little girl or boy for being pretty or smart. But the bulk of your praise should come on the effort that they make. So they begin to develop the cheshbon, that good effort, hard effort equals feeling good. Any questions on that? Okay, just in the interest of time, I think we only go to 35, and we start a little late. So I'm going to cut out some jokes, but the good news is just the bad ones. Like that. Okay. Something else very important to keep in mind in a child with self-esteem, raising a child with self-esteem, and that is diet and exercise physiology. If you have a child that is particularly difficult, particularly challenging, you have to look at the diet. My boy had a sitter party, 5 years old, and they got, it was catered by a very nice Flachic place, and they got cans of Coke. Now, you have a little kid who's, he happens to be a big kid, but, a little kid of, 40 pounds, and you multiply that out to an adult, come on, right? I mean, sugar and caffeine affects us. We drink it to stay awake. And we bounce off walls. Imagine a child without an allergy. We're not talking about a food allergy. We're not talking about a predisposition. We're not talking about a sensitivity, which can also set them off. A study was done in England for an additive, a food coloring, that was causing a lot of behavioral issues. So we have to be particularly sensitive to the child's diet, sugar, caffeine, and any type of allergy. The very first step, if you're experiencing any type of disciplinary issues with the child that seems to be extending beyond the norm, is to take a look at the diet with a nutritionist or allergist. There's a school district in Dallas, Texas, who had a very, very difficult time with one of the classes, so much so that they brought in a teacher from out of state. When the teacher was in the principal's office, she was flipping through the files, and she noticed something extraordinary about this class. This class was filled with children who had extraordinarily high IQs. The file showed 160, 170, 182, 190, 196. She couldn't believe it. They'd given her a class full of geniuses. So she walked into this class that was extremely unruly, pretty much dodging a chair, and she began to talk to them and respond to them, and they were completely not paying attention. But over time, when she would ask a question, she thought, okay, this is how little Einsteins respond. Let me think about this. Over time, this class turned from F's and D's to A's and B's. And this is, by the way, this is not one of those story stories. This is actually a verifiable story. She was named that teacher of the state, but teacher of the year, the national scale. At the awards ceremony, she was speaking with the superintendent, and she sheepishly said, "I don't know what all the fuss is about." Granted, they were unruly, but I'm a certified teacher, I'm trained, I know how to deal with kids. You know, he gave me a class full of geniuses, I turned them around, what's the big deal? The superintendent said, "What are you talking about?" And she said, "Look at the files." So he looks at the files, and she says, "There you go." And he flips through them, and he says, "Ma'am, those are not their IQs, those are the locker numbers." There was a study done that showed an amazing thing. Not only do our expectations change a child's behavior, adults as well, by the way, but they can actually change the child's IQ. There's a study done in the 70s, I have it, I won't go into the details, but it was duplicated over 100 times because I couldn't believe the results. Rosenfeld, and I'll take a look if you want. You can find it online easy enough. I'm not sure I have it here. The study showed that the average IQ of the class went up 20 points for each child, average. What the teacher was told is that you can expect this class to learn very quickly and to absorb information at a faster rate than usual. The actual, understand please, the actual IQ of the children changed. And the study has been duplicated over 100 times. Your expectations play a very powerful role in how your child will respond. For good, bad, or indifferent. When I was speaking once about this, a woman shared something, and that was that when her children were younger, she said she found out what their IQs were, and she said she wished she had never done that, because one of her children ends up having a lower IQ. And I said, "And you couldn't help but treat him a little differently." And she said, "Yeah." Now, what's the biggest crime of all of this? And that is that there are different types of intelligences. There are people that will score very low on a standardized IQ test, and some of them become president or vice president. And we know people who are verifiable geniuses that are complete emotional wrecks. David Ogilvy, anyone remember him from Ogilvy & Mather, big advertising agency back in the, well, it's still big, but it was booming, in the 80s. He had written in his autobiography that he always thought he was particularly smart. There's no reason to think he wasn't. He created a multi-billion dollar industry pretty much himself. He said it turned out his IQ was something like 96 or something, and he had it measured years after he retired. He said, "Had I known how dumb I was before I started, I never would have done anything." Now, there's a fine line here between early intervention and recognizing when a child needs additional help. Some of you may know I read an article, a column for the Jewish Press, and my sister-in-law happens to be a terrific speech therapist, and we were speaking about this point when she took umbrage with my column on this, and she said that parents very often, they'll hide the fact that a child has a disability or something wrong because they don't want the child to be stigmatized. And she's 100% right. And the point here is that you want to make sure that if your child needs additional help in something, they need additional coaching, they need teaching, they need learning to help with a particular issue, that's great. There's a difference between that and labeling your child as slow, ADHD, a stigma, can't sit, can't pay attention. Because the teachers can't help respond to that child differently, you can't help respond to that child differently, and the child can't help to respond to your expectations. So how we treat our child, the expectations that we have, play a very powerful role in their actual behavior, and as studies show us, in their actual development. Any questions, by the way? We just have another 2 moments. Okay. Miserable parents will raise miserable children. There's not a lot of room to get around that equation. Sometimes I work at, I don't work actually, my wife works at Camp Sternberg. Anyone know Camp Sternberg? Terrific girls' camp in the summer upstate in Narrowsburg. My wife is a program director at Sternberg, so I go along for the ride. And you know, sometimes I'll speak to some of the girls, and on visiting day, I could sit on the porch, and out of the 1,500 girls, pretty much match up the problem kids with the parents as they walk through the gates, right? You can just sort of get a flavor for which parent goes with which kid based on the issues. A parent will sometimes say, you know, my kid's got this, this, and that. Joy, simcha, it's an obligation for us as observant Jews. It's an obligation for you to instill it in your child. I speak also on Kiruv, and I talk to Kiruv professionals. And the fundamental, one of the fundamental ideas is a sense of simcha. We talk about kids going off the derech. We talk about how to be makar people. Simcha is at the crux of this. Because if you talk to a non-religious person and you're miserable, they're thinking, why do I want any part of this? I can be miserable all by myself and still go out Friday night. I don't need you for that. Right? And so I see Kiruv guys, and you know, you gotta, and some of the best ones, the magical ones, are the ones that just have this smile. And so kids too, they gain a lot from just simply soaking you up. We began by saying emotional well-being, self-esteem, it's different for children than adults. Again, by adults, we gain it by making good choices. By children, it's helping a child to recognize they're the path to your happiness and not the obstacle to it. Any child that grows up to made to feel like a chore and obligation cannot help but feel like they are something less. Because again, kids are egocentric. Okay, the question is, where are my books and tapes available for sale? They're available, okay, to have them be Barnes & Noble, but that wasn't your actual question. The question is, where do you balance it? There's absolutely, not only is there nothing wrong, but it's necessary for a parent to correct the child. But please be clear that a parent sometimes will think that the job of the parent is to point out everything the child is doing wrong, and then you're doing your parenting. There are plenty of times one of my kids will come home and they'll say something like, look what I did wrong from the teacher, and a complete unbelievable sentence, which is grating on the ears. And I don't point out, nor should anyone, every time that they use a wrong verb, a wrong action. Man, we know people like this. We have friends like this. They're constantly correcting us. They're annoying to be around. They're miserable. They make us miserable. You don't need to do it with your kids. Particularly when it comes to Lashon Hara. Also, I mentioned Rabbi Yitzhak Berkowitz. If your child is excited about a story, they're telling something over, you don't need to cut them short and say, whoa, stop, Lashon Hara, Lashon Hara. You know, there is what to say for letting your child, again, whichever way is age appropriate and based on their level of understanding, to let them finish, laugh along with them, enjoy the story, and then afterwards gently, kindly, respectively point out that it would have been just as funny, or just you would have gotten the point if they didn't mention names and so on. So your child needs to be corrected, but there's a difference between that and an endless stream of criticism. Yes, please. Let me ask you a question. Yeah. Do you know any adult that uses the word brung today? They're going to get it. They're going to get it now. You know.
But then, however, a speech therapist can tell me better that you should correct them rather than their friends make fun of them.
Okay.
So if you're making fun of, you know, verbal mistakes, then it's better that you should
right. Now, the question is, a speech therapist would say better correct them than have their peers. Yeah, so look, you have to be sensitive to what's going on. You have to recognize that the child's capable of it. If he's using brung, odds are lots of his friends are too. If he's speaking incorrectly, this again, our job as parents is to educate our children. That doesn't mean at every conversation it's a reason to critique. Okay, we are going to conclude this now. We're going to start another session, I think, in about 3 minutes. So you're welcome to move about the cabin. Real power is available. You're very welcome. Thank you very much. Thank you.
Thank you for listening to this presentation brought to you by Priority One. Please visit us online at www.priority-one.org. That's priority-1.org, where you can download free audio and publications on parenting, teaching, and teens at risk. For more information or to make a donation, please visit us online or call 800-33-4EVER.